One of the ways of talking about this process of being present for our immediate experience, being present to have a knowing presence for what's happening in the present moment, is to think of the practice as being a process of revelation. And revelation is not a particularly Buddhist word, but the idea that things are just being revealed. And, you know, revelation is, you know, where does it come from? Things are being revealed, so an itch is being revealed. That's what's happening now, or a sound outside, or a thought, or a feeling. These things are being revealed. And that what's being revealed is, in some way or other, is constantly changing. It's always in flux, always moving. That if you really stay in the present moment, what you'll be aware of is things will change. Your attention will change, focus on different things. What you're focusing on will change as you pay attention to it in some way or other. That one of the things you become aware of is there's a constant change and flux. And in fact, the idea of permanence, the idea that something actually doesn't change, more often than not, is there because we're not in the present moment, but rather in our thoughts and our ideas. And it's to a great extent, the idea of permanence is a concept that the mind makes up, and that when we live too much in the mind and our thoughts, then things can seem permanent. So, you know, I mean, it's fairly common, I think, for some people to have the experience of to know that their depression, maybe, or maybe their whatever they're feeling, their anger, maybe it's going to be impermanent, maybe it'll pass at some point. But in the day that it's happening, it's like, oh my God, this is it. You know, this is permanent. I'm going to be this way forever. But if you really stay there with the experience, it'll change. It'll flow and move for most things. So the process of revelation, for me, is a helpful idea for the practice. So as I said before lunch, the first kind of major turning in the Buddhist kind of system or whatever that Buddhist system is that of refuge. Somehow feeling that this, yes, something kind of great ascent, the great yes, this, there's a new way I want to live my life, new kind of orientation for my life, and I want to place this somewhere near the center of my life, maybe at the center of my life, or close enough that I want to acknowledge this is a very important organizing principle for my life, and that somehow, in some way, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha reflect this new value, or this new possibility, this new experience. Having that deep conviction and trust and confidence in this thing we call the refuges, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, certainly can help a person relax and be more trusting, and brings with it the kind of the tools of learning how to be in the present moment, paying attention to the present moment. It's very important to develop a certain degree of integrity. Without integrity, you can't enter the stream. You need to, what it says, in order to enter the stream, you need to have a certain kind of deep conviction in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and you need to have a strong conviction, and not even more than conviction, you need to actually be a person of integrity. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because if you want to be in the stream, you have to, in a sense, become the stream. And if part of you is holding back from the stream, then you can't be the stream. And being the stream is to have integrity. Integrity has a lot to do with being very honest about what's actually happening for you, who you are, what's going on, what your experience is. And I think that, for me, lays at the bottom of integrity. And if you don't have that kind of integrity, how can you expect then to become the stream or to enter the stream? Because you're holding back in some way. You're standing on the shore, kind of looking at the river instead of going into it. So it requires a very, my experience is, a very deep, thorough honesty about what's going on right now. Getting real about who we are, what's going on. And then bringing presence, bringing awareness, bringing mindfulness to what that experience actually is. To recognize it, to be honest about it, to be real about it, and then to bring careful mindfulness to it. And if we do that, we'll notice a lot of things that get in the way. We'll notice that there's fear, many things you mentioned today. You notice that there's ideas that this shouldn't be, ideas that I have to fix it. All kinds of ideas that get in the way of just letting yourself fully be there for that experience as it actually is, as if it has permission to be there. As if it has a right to be there in its own glory, its own situation. So you have, you know, whatever it might be, you have murderous rage. And so you want to be able to be completely honest about that, that's what's happening. And then you want to be able to almost enter it with mindfulness, really be present for it. And have that kind of, and in that doing, have a lot of integrity, be very real in what's going on. As a person, as you begin to kind of enter the stream of the present moment, seeing what's there, being very present for the immediacy of your experience, one element that gets born, it comes with that, is the arising of discrimination or discernment. To be able to see the cause and effect relationship of things. To see that things arise, that things pass. That things arise because of certain conditions, and they pass because of certain conditions. And so it's not just simply kind of riding the present moment like a wave and only seeing that edge of that wave. But it's also having, the mind naturally will have some little bit larger sense of a cause and effect relationship that's going on. You don't have to manufacture it. You don't have to look for that cause and effect relationship. But as you enter into the deep stream, the mind itself is a discerning faculty. And it's sooner or later, when it's calm and relaxed and really seeing, it'll start seeing simple things. It'll start seeing the arising and passing of things, how they arise and pass, what the cause and effect relationship that things are in. Now, this beginning to see the arising and passing of things, their arising and their ceasing, is very, very important in the course of Buddhist practice. And in fact, it's one of the ways, one of the descriptions in the ancient texts for the kind of insight a person needs to have that's synonymous with becoming a stream enterer. So the next turning, big turning after refuge, is that of becoming a stream enterer. And that is more than just the act of conviction or faith or confidence in something. But it's somehow what we have confidence in, what we have deep trust in, what we intuit or sense, actually has turned us, has actually changed us in some radical way. So we allowed ourselves to be changed. And not everyone is willing to allow themselves to be changed. In principle, we might want to be changed, but not at the expense of being present for what's really going on. I mean, you know, anything but that. So let me develop some really good concentration and avoid what's going on. But you want to really be present. Oh, so the second turning is becoming a stream enterer. And it's usually understood to be the first experience of awakening, of bodhi, of realization, of nirvana, of enlightenment. You know, there's always these more words for it. And the Theravada tradition, the early Buddhist tradition, posits that there are four stages in becoming enlightened. And the first one is becoming a stream enterer. The second is becoming a once returner. The third is becoming a non-returner. And the fourth is called an arhat. What these mean is that a stream enterer is someone who's entered the stream of the Dharma. And now the Dharma, or reality, is going to carry them because they're now inclined, they're leaning in that direction. Reality is going to carry them to full liberation, no matter what. It'll happen sooner or later. And what it says, what the tradition says, it'll happen within 7 lifetimes. So there are people then who become stream enterers and they stop practicing because they feel like, I got it made. It's not going to happen this lifetime. I know that. It's not going to be further. But I know I got it made. And so they just coast, you know. And I don't know what happens to them. They coast for 6 lifetimes and the 7th lifetime, you know, they just, something happens. I don't know. But the idea is that once you've gotten that experience of liberation, that then things are have turned and changed for you, so there's no turning back. You're in the water, you're in the stream, the current. It's going to carry you no matter what. The second level, or second stage of awakening, is called a once-returner. And this is a much more thorough or fuller transformation from this experience of nirvana. And now the person is guaranteed, so deeply in the stream, maybe it's in the fast part of the river. And now the person, it's going to happen much faster, and the person's only going to be reborn one more time. So again, you could coast if you want. But next lifetime, it's really going to happen. You're guaranteed only one more lifetime before you reach your full awakening. The third stage is a higher degree of transformation, and this is called a non-returner. And here the idea is that you're so deeply in the stream. Now it's just rushing by. You're rushing in it. And you're not going to be reborn at all as a human being. But you will be reborn in some kind of celestial realm that's very fantastic to get born into. And in that wonderful place, you'll have your final liberation or awakening, your freedom. And then the fourth and final stage of awakening is what's called an arhat. And the word arhat simply means someone who's worthy, a worthy one. And And this is someone who has been transformed completely by this dream. And this is where sometimes people say they now have become this dream. Some people will say that stream entry, it's kind of like, it's maybe mixing metaphors or ideas to in a confused way, but it's kind of like if you if you're out in the desert and you just can't believe that there's any water here in the desert, and you're parched and thirsty, and it just, you've been looking for years for water, and it's just getting worse and worse. You're dying of thirst, and you can't believe there's any water here. And then finally, you come across a little pond, an oasis in the desert, and you say, "Wow! Now you really know there is water here. You're standing at the edge of it. You really know there's water. Isn't that something? You have confidence. You're convinced about the possibility of water. There's no doubt in your mind that water exists, but you really see it. You know it. You know you can't go back now. Your mind's not going to go back. You're convinced. You know it." And that would be like stream entry. And becoming fully awakened would mean that you just dove right in. You dove into the pond, and you didn't even hold yourself back. You just plunged into it. And in a sense, you become the pond, become the stream. You become the Dharma, becoming being Dharma. There's no difference between you and the Dharma, the flowing of Dharma. Until that point, there is probably always going to be some, what it says, it's always going to be some divide between you and the Dharma, you and the flow of reality in the present moment, that somehow you hold yourself apart from it. I'm here, reality is there, and I'm experiencing it. And there's different ways in which we hold ourselves apart, in which ways, different ways in which this relationship to reality exists, and the different levels of enlightenment have to do with the transformation or the purification of these, some of these different dimensions or realms that we are doing it. So the stream entry in the Theravada tradition is considered a very, very important milestone in someone's practice. And many people in the Theravada tradition are practicing in order to become stream enterers. A lot of teachers are hoping their students to bring them to stream entry. There's places in Asia that sometimes are known, sometimes casually called stream entry factories, because they seem to have a high success rate in leading people to stream entry. And so in terms of some kind of experience of realization, in the Theravada tradition, that's the one that's considered the most common, easiest to attain, and the most commonly talked about. After that, people don't talk so much about what happens after that, the other stages. Now, what happens in Asia is that there are many different schools of meditation, many different school teachers, and they have different definitions of what constitutes stream entry. You know, what is that moment? What is that experience like? What defines someone when they become a stream enter? And so then you can have wonderful inter-religious dialogues or debates, fights, conflicts about, you know, my stream entry is better, my criteria of stream entry is better than yours. Or, you know, that teacher said it, you have stream entry? Well, you can't be. That's nothing like stream entry, because stream entry is this, you know. And so it's just ugly when you get into the world of trying to decide who has it and what it is and all that. And it's kind of unfortunate. But, you know, so different people have different ideas of what that's supposed to be. Some of it focuses on being really clear about what the stream entry experience exactly is, as if there's some particular experience that it actually is. The most common way in the suttas that the Buddha describes stream entry, kind of describes it, is he says that you know that someone has stream entry when they're a stream enterer when they have unshakable confidence in the Buddha, unshakable confidence in the Dharma, unshakable confidence in the Sangha, and they're endowed with the virtue that wise people would praise. So you can decide for yourself. Do you have unshakable confidence in these things? And is your virtue such that a wise person would come in here and say, "Oh yeah, that's good how you are"? Or do you have something you want to hide because you steal pencils from work and, you know, or something? So that makes it kind of less mystical. It's not like focusing on some great experience, but rather on the level of kind of, you know, something that's kind of discernible about how strong your confidence is. Another way in which the tradition talks about the experience, the early suttas talk about the experience of stream entry, is that it involves the very clear seeing that things arise and pass. That things arise because of conditions and they pass because of conditions. And there's something about seeing that that leads to an experience of liberation. And I'll try my best to explain that. I would like to read one quote from the suttas of a man who attained stream entry, a description of it. In its Sutta 56 in this middle-length discourse. It's a householder whose name was Upali. So the Buddha talked to him for a while, and then the Buddha... So here, I'll give you read the whole thing. The Buddha gave Upali progressive instructions, that is, talk on generosity, talk on virtue, talk on heavens. He explained the danger and the defilement that comes with sensual pleasures and the blessings of letting go. When you knew that the householder of Pali's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated and confident, he expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas, suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. Just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while the householder Upali sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him, and he had the thought, all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Then the householder Upali saw the Dharma, attained the Dharma, understood the Dharma, fathomed the Dharma, he crossed beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Then he said to the... Oh, that's okay. So here, this vision or statement, all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. There's something about seeing that. So it's not a belief, it's not understanding it, but there's something in the direct seeing of the arising and passing of things, that something passes away and something arises, that is liberating and enlightening. And in seeing that, the person is transformed very radically, and there's no more any doubts. The spotless Dharma eye, vision of the Dharma, has arisen. Dharma, having a Dharma eye is the same thing as becoming a stream enterer. So, in order to maybe explain this a little bit, why this might be so, it might be helpful to understand a little bit more about the transformation that's supposed to happen when a person becomes a stream enterer. With stream entry, the person is said to eradicate, remove, destroy, bring to an end three what's called fetters, three things that keeps the mind or the heart bound or shackled or in prison a little bit. And after all, liberation is being liberated, right? So liberated from what? That which keeps us liberated. So the tradition has these words like, you know, shackles or bars or prisons and things like that. So so stream entry involves the ending of three. And the first one has to do with getting caught up in the world in obsessions and clinging to self-identity, to see anything as being this is who I am. And in the Buddhological language of these texts, it'll say that the person will no longer see that the body is self, that our feelings are self, that perceptions are self, that mental content, mental formations, mental attitudes and tendencies are self, or that awareness or consciousness itself is self. But in our kind of modern language, I think it's very fair and more maybe easier if we see it, as a person is no longer liable to take anything as this defines who I am. Most people are taking things as this defines who I am. Often that happens in relationship to other people. We define ourselves in relationship to other people or other ideals or all kinds of things. And so we're looking in a sense outside of ourselves and creating a definition of who I am, how I want to represent myself or how I think I'm representing myself or how I don't want to represent myself. This whole world of selfing, of self-identity. Who we think we are in relationship to other people. So, you know, I am a kind person. So I might be a kind person, but to cling or hold on to the identity, I am a kind person, is to fall into this fetter. And why it's called a fetter or a prison is that once I get caught in the idea I am a kind person, I define myself that way, I've limited myself. I've contracted myself. I've narrowed myself in who I am, my definition of who I am. Any definition or any idea, any particular idea of who I am is much, can be much smaller than our capacity to be aware, to be conscious. It's kind of like consciousness or awareness is bigger, but bigger than what we define ourselves by. So I don't know if you've had the experience of kind of being present for, you can even do it now, let's do a little exercise. Just where you are, close your eyes. And then think of some way, historically or in the present moment, something that you think defines who you are, some idea of identity. maybe even one that hurts to have. But it doesn't have to be one that hurts. It could be anything. Some concept, idea of this is who I am. I am this way. And then quietly say it to yourself. I am this. I am. And now say it again. And the next time you say it, as you say it, see if you can relax into a wider sense of presence, wider sense of being, that's much bigger and broader and expansive than anything that's represented by that particular thought. So, you can open your eyes. I've never asked anyone to do that before. I just made it up. How did it work? What happened? Is that meaningful at all? Did it point to anything? Give you a sense of something?
First, figure out which of the many things that from time to time I find myself by, I was going to choose the exercise. And having chosen that, I could see how it was a contraction, uh-huh. an exclusion. And even within that category, I was starting to narrow it down. So I think it conveyed that. Uh-huh. Although to me, the interesting thing is the first thing where I realized how many different ones.
Crowded. Someone else? Yes?
I just saw it just a concept.
You saw it as a concept?
Uh-huh. Just a concept of thinking who I am, idea, not really.
Uh-huh. So the first of these, so with stream entry comes a clear seeing enough of something that shows a person that any kind of definition of who we are is inadequate as a representation of who we are. And since most of us go around most of the time seeing the world through a self-identity, that's a very radical transformation for some people. So you see, oh, it doesn't make any sense to define myself X, Y, and Z. If I do that, I mean, conventionally it does. I mean, I could say that here at IMC, I'm a Dharma teacher. I could say that. It's a fair enough statement to make. If my psyche in some deeper way is holding onto that, clinging to that, then I become less than who I am. I become less than what reality is. There's kind of a contraction, a limiting that goes on. And if I stay in that limitation, it hurts. And it's possible for someone to stay in that kind of limitation for a lifetime and not know that anything else is possible. And stay in that kind of contraction and think that that's the way reality is made. That's what, you know, how could it be any different? This is what, you know. And it really takes something radical to break the shell. See, oh, there's a whole other way. The analogy for this given in the suttas is that of a blind person who is given a cloth to hold, maybe to, you know, wipe his face or blow his nose or something, I don't know what. But given this cloth. But it's an oily and grimy cloth. You know, stinky and, you know, not stinky, that wouldn't work for the analogy, but grimy and just oily and ugly. And then at some point, this person takes all this medicine and his or her eyesight is restored. And the person sees, wow, this stuff is really grimy. What am I doing carrying this and wiping my face with this oily, grimy kind of cloth? So the same way I said with ourselves, that if we always stay in this contracted world of self-identity, we might think that this is just fine, this is the way it's supposed to be. But when the Dharma eye is opened, they say, well, wow, how could I have been holding on to that? That doesn't make any sense. It's painful to hold on to that. Why would anybody want to? Why would anybody bother? But until the shell has been broken, it's the whole reality is that contraction, and how would a person know there's anything else? So the first transformation is in this basically kind of around a belief. A person no longer believes that any of these things. Well, belief is not the right word here. The person has seen in such a deep way that it isn't just a matter of believing or being convinced, but in some way having the visceral feeling, having the physical, mental experience of what it's like to have a presence which is not contracted around a self-identity. To actually see that in a very, very thorough, deep way, so that memory of that or that experience then becomes something that maybe not always present, but it's close at hand. That you really, that possibility of having an identity or having a way of being a presence which is not contracted around a self is so obvious because it's so you can experience it so close at hand. And because it's so close at hand, the tendency, the desire to cling is not going to, you know, it's going to loosen up more and more and more. They enter the stream, and they're going to just want to let go, and let go, because why bother doing this? Why bother picking up this dirty cloth again? The second transformation is a transformation of... at this point, the person is said to have no more doubt. There's no more uncertainty. And doubt itself, or uncertainty, is a fetter, is a hindrance. It keeps us back, keeps us inhibited, or keeps us confused, or keeps us from plunging in fully. And what it says a number of things. One is that until that experience of stream entry, until you have the experience of actually radically stepping outside of that shell of self, the person is always going to have some doubt, some remnants of doubt, about the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. Even though their faith or their conviction or the trust is very deep, they're always going to have some doubt because they haven't actually tasted it or seen it for themselves. It's like you're in that desert and you have the map. The map says, yeah, there's water over there. But, you know, can you really trust this map? I mean, that map was written 2,500 years ago and, you know, lakes rise and pass, they dry up, and, you know, how could you really know? But once you see it, you know that the lake is there because you've seen it. So then there's no more doubt about the existence of that lake. So once you had this experience, then there's no more doubt about the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. It's kind of like then you have no doubt about that the Buddha was really liberated. Yeah, so if this happened to me, this is what could have happened to the Buddha. This is what happened to the Buddha. And for some people, it's a kind of almost like an act of imagination. Then you can say, wow, I know what's possible now. And a Buddha must be someone who's really integrated this possibility into their full being. Isn't that awesome? Isn't that amazing? The analogy I like to use is based on when we used to be over in Portola Valley. Portola Valley had this linoleum floor that had squares in it, you know, one square foot linoleum tiles. And sometimes we'd get there Sunday morning and they'd have a party the night before, and you could smell the beer that had spilled on the floor and it was all sticky and everything. Well, imagine that linoleum floor with all the partying and everything that happened there. And it wasn't cleaned for 500 years. You know, the doors are kept open and dust comes in. And slowly, over the centuries, you know, the dust and the beer and the everything, the zafu dust and everything kind of builds and builds and builds. Until finally you have, you know, maybe like, I don't know, a foot of... not just dust and grime, but it's because people have been sitting there and walking and dancing. It's really packed down. It's really solid, like baked, you know, with the hot summer weather and stuff like that. It's really, and after 500 years, people, you know, don't even remember there was a floor down there. I mean, no. It's just, you know, this is what it is. And then someone comes across some little reference in the back files of Portola Valley City Council that there's a linoleum floor there. And there's no one, my father doesn't, my mother doesn't remember, their parents don't remember, their great-grandparents don't remember, there's no way, someone said, yeah, I think there must be. So someone has the tenacity to start chiseling away at that floor, and it's really hard, you know, and it takes a lot of work, chiseling and banging and jacksawing, and slowly, finally, they get down to the linoleum floor, and they clear out one square foot tile. And they see, wow, it's a beautiful shot tile. I can polish it a little bit and put some wax on it. And it's really something. It's beautiful and smooth and wow. And now that person knows, yes, in fact, there is an linoleum floor down there. There's no doubt about it. Now they can imagine there's probably linoleum all the way out to the walls. A Buddha is someone who's cleaned the linoleum all the way out to the walls. And the whole floor is clean. So you can, that's kind of, you can imagine. You know, once you have that experience, you can imagine what a Buddha might be like. Yes?
So I have a question. A lot of us have had experience of things like being shifting and impermanent, especially in our meditations, particularly. When you just asked us to do this one, it wasn't even what I defined myself by, wasn't even who I was and was limiting. But the other part was there wasn't even me. It's just an echo. It's an echo of saying, I'm confident. But that doesn't do anything. I mean, really permanently. I mean, I have to think about it. And I say, you know, there maybe isn't anything. So what you're saying in terms of the lonely fly, I feel that I sometimes get a glimpse. It's such a short glimpse.
Right.
When stream entry, are you able to always find that lonely fly? And as soon as you say, let me look at the lonely fly, then there it appears.
Maybe this is where I lost track of myself before. Pick up from something earlier. The different meditation traditions have different definitions of what stream entry is. And sometimes, even within certain traditions, people can have the experience of stream entry in different ways. And some people can have it so it's really clear that something transformative and powerful has happened. The Big Bang, you know, theory of religious life. And other people, it's like a whimper. It's like something happens and they don't even know it themselves. It's maybe the teacher who knows it. They come and report and talk to the teacher, and the teacher says, oh, yes. You know, the teacher recognizes it, but they don't recognize it. You know, it's very important not to look for, you know, a particular experience as being the thing, but it's experienced in a variety of ways. But in some way or other, it changes the person in some fundamental way. Now, it's possible to have an intuition or a glimpse or, you know, in some sense, the world of enlightenment, the world of Nibbana, the deathless dimension that we have up there on the wall, is always here with us. So it's something that's always present. So it's possible to get some kind of relationship to it, some glimpse or some sense or intuition of it, you know, available to anybody if you kind of help people. But it's one thing to kind of get a kind of some glimpse of it. It's another thing to see it so thoroughly and completely that you've been changed by it, irrevocably changed. So doubt, and it's also said that with the removal of the fetter of doubt, that's when a person really knows what the practice is all about. There's no doubt about the practice anymore. And maybe it sounds a little bit discouraging, but it's kind of like you don't even know what practice is until you become a stream enter. And some people are practicing in order to become a stream enter and going to spiritual retirement then. In a sense, you don't really can't really know what practice is all really about until you've had that turning, that glimpse. And the third fetter is that of clinging, attachment to, it's usually translated as rites and rituals. Clinging to, the literal translation would be clinging to precepts or virtue, clinging to virtue, clinging to ethics, and clinging to, and it's either religious practices, one translation of it, or the other possible translation is to vows. It has both meanings, to religious vows. And I like to take it in the broadest sense. It's any attachment to being ethical and any attachment to religious practices of any kind at all, whether it's rituals or, you know, crystals or, you know, anything. Now, this doesn't mean that because in giving up attachment to rites and rituals, to practices and ethics, that you're supposed to be unethical or not to engage in religious practice, spiritual practice. It means you're not attached to it. And there's a number of ways in which people are attached to these things. One way has to do with self-identity. People's identity can be deeply invested into being spiritual. You know, look at me, I'm cool. You know, this is the way they have the best identity on the block. And so that's one way people get attached to it. Another way is that out of a sense of fear or hope or insecurity, I need to hold on to something for dear life so that I could, you know, get by in life. And so I'm going to hold on to these rites and rituals. And that's a constriction. That blocks the free flow of our life. The other way that is that it's a confusion about what will lead to liberation. And so people think, oh, if I'm just ethical enough, that will lead me to liberation. If I follow certain rituals, that itself will bring me to liberation. But when you have stream entry, then the person really realizes that it's not a matter of rituals, not a matter of the practice, spiritual practice, different kinds of techniques of practice. It's not about vows or, you know, being a religious person. It really has to do with being able to see very directly some very deep aspect of reality, of our mind, how it works. That's what it takes, is that kind of seeing. So then you're not going to hold on or be attached to these things that they're going to get you enlightened, because you realize they're not going to do it. They might be supportive, but in and of themselves, they are not going to get you liberated. So those are the three fetters that get dropped away with stream entry. In a sense, they're cognitive. They have to do with understanding. You understand something about identity, or, you know, that fundamentally self-identity, the usual forms of self-identity we have, the little self, the egotistical self that we have, the ego self, which we often orient ourselves life around, is only part of the picture, and it's a kind of a contraction that gets in the way of being free. Understanding about doubt and what is and is not the path. And then the last one, understanding about rites and rituals, practices and ethics. The next fetters, the next two fetters, which are diminished for once returners and eradicated for non-returners, is sensual desire and ill will. And so after stream entry, a person still has sensual desire, still has capacity for ill will. Becoming a once-returner just diminishes it. You have less after that. And you're less clinging to sensual pleasures of all kinds and to ill will. And then becoming a non-returner, then that's finished with you. You no longer have any clinging or drive or attachment to sensual pleasures or to ill will, having ill will. And so those are affective. They're more, a little more to the affective side of our life, the emotional side. And you can see kind of that the intellectual side, the cognitive side of our life, of understanding, is a lot easier to penetrate and break through than the emotional aspects of our life, which is represented by sensual pleasure and ill will. So stream enterer. So a stream enterer is one who sees into the world of impermanence very deeply. Sees the arising of things and the passing of things. Sees that with the arising of something, it'll pass away. Now, why is that so transformative? One is that as you see impermanence with enough directness, with much immediacy, without any filters, without any attachments getting in the way, then you realize you can't find any self in that experience. You can't find anything in that experience which makes any sense to define this is who I am. So when you see rising and passing strong enough that you can look around and say, it doesn't make any sense. That's on the way to stream entry. There is tremendous equanimity about that. It's one thing to see that, but then you can be afraid. People panic at this point because we tend to organize ourselves in our life and feel safe by how we, by through the filter of our self-identity, who we think we are, who we think we need to protect, or how people see us, how we want people to see us, all this whole game of self-identity. When you see through that, begin to see through that, it can be very frightening because then what's left? How am I going to trust reality then? How do I take care of myself? You know, is it safe to be so exposed and transparent? You know, I have to kind of hold myself and protect myself, you know. And so some people will panic. But when the practice goes deeper and that experience of arising passing is something we relax into and develop a tremendous equanimity about, then at some point there can be a seeing, a kind of an experience of that which is not arising and passing. And to give you a little intimation of how this might work, when we sit down to meditate, when the mind is agitated and very busy and active, the body can seem solid and fixed. As the mind gets stiller, the body is experienced to be more a field of changing sensations and flux. And its solidity begins to dissolve into a sense of flow and movement. As the mind gets stiller, there's a juxtaposition between the mind that's still and the body that's moving. But the mind itself, even though it's quite still, is a kind of a movement, maybe much more subtle. It arises and passes also. And there is something which is not arising and passing. So, and that is called, in the tradition, one of the ways is it's called the deathless. When the Dharma eye arises, the person not only sees arising and passing, but sees that which is in the cracks of the rising and passes, or that which is other than, or sees that which is able to be the container for rising and passing, or that which is outside of arising and passing, that dimension of consciousness of awareness which is not subject to arising and passing. And that's called deathless, and I liken it very much to the experience of timelessness because it has no definition in time. It has a sense, the sense that it's always been there and always will be here. But it just doesn't make any sense in that kind of that dimension of consciousness to talk about where it came from or what made it happen, what constructed it, and what conditioned it, or that it's going to pass away. It has a kind of timeless quality to it. What happens to the timeless present? Does it disappear? Moments disappear, right? This moment's going to go into the past, right? Just did. The timeless present, does that disappear? I think in the subjective experience of the timeless present, it's just always here. It's eternal, in a sense. The eternal present, they say. So the deathless has that same kind of quality. Some teachers will say that it really is permanent. You know, never had to be. It's always been. And some teachers will say, well, you know, it's subjectively it feels that way, but you know, who knows? It's a dimension of consciousness. So in the early texts, that's the primary way in which people talk about stream entry. Teachers in Asia, one of the reasons why they want to have these stream entry factories, why they're so focused on that, it's kind of like a born-again kind of thing where, you know, if you get saved, you know, if you believe in Jesus, then you're saved, you're taken care of, you'll be okay. And until then, you're not going to be okay. Well, it's kind of like the same thing in Buddhism, I'm sorry to say. I'm a little bit shy to say. Is that once you have a stream enter, then you're assured. The word is assured or guaranteed. The word is usually translated as assured, but guaranteed, that you will be fully liberated within 7 lifetimes. So the teacher no longer has to worry about you anymore. You're set. get a person that far and they're set, you know. And what they do, you know, they can do what they do. And it'd be nice if they keep practicing, but you know, they're set. So what do you think of that? Do you have any questions at this point?
How do you know what lifetime you're in?
Could be the 7th one.
is there any way to know?
There probably is. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know about lifetimes myself. But this is what they believe in. And there are people who supposedly can somehow see people's rebirth and look back in the past and see things. And
well, he was born into the culture, but he spent his whole life proving to himself that there was no self offline. How could there be a transmigration of souls? Or I mean, he proved that there wasn't any.
No, the Buddha didn't prove that there's no self. What he realized is that
For our purposes, I mean, so there's metaphysical speculation.
Right, that's what Buddha said. Any kind of discussion about self is metaphysical speculation is not needed. So
why did they talk about
rebirth stages? Oh, there's a difference between a metaphysical self and an empirical self. If I have an itch, I don't scratch you. You know, the itch is here. And, you know, if I need to pee, you know, I don't send someone else to do it for me. You know, I'm the one who has to do that. So there is some integrity or something that happens in this stream of life that's here that we recognize as having some integrity in that stream. And what the Buddhist tradition will say is that stream will continue beyond one lifetime. But in that stream of arising and passing phenomena, it doesn't make any sense to point to any particular thing saying, this is the self. If you want to casually say, this is the self that gets reborn, I think the Buddha is okay with that. But there is no thing that's being reborn. It's a stream of arising and passing phenomena. Now, it gets more interesting than this. So as I said, the stream entry involves seeing through or dropping the fetter of self-identity. You're no longer liable to take something as being definition of who you are. There can still remain the sense. So to put that in kind of logical words, it's any kind of statement that can fit the formula, I am blank. I am, you know, whatever. When a person realizes that the blank, it doesn't make any sense to limit oneself or to contract oneself around the blank in any kind of way. There can remain a sense, an intuitive sense or a feeling of I am-ness. Yes, I understand that there doesn't make any sense to, you know, identify myself with anything, but there's still a sense of I am-ness that remains. So we don't fill in the blank, just I am, not I am blank. I am. There's an am-ness here, I am here. And that can feel much freer and broader, more expansive, spacious, than any kind of contracted sense of self that comes, you know, with I am blank. That sense of I am is understood in tradition to still be a fetter. It's still a form of contraction, even though it can feel, in contrast to what you had, pretty, pretty wonderful. The arhat, the last final stage of enlightenment, is someone who has also let go of the fetter of I am-ness. And that's why they said that arhat is someone who's entered the stream, has become the stream. There's no separation between them and, you know, I am here and the world out there. So that's the highest level of realization. Yeah?
I didn't quite understand the difference. Did you say what I am is?
the intuitive sense of emness, I am.
So
just I existing.
So I am a teacher in the I am sense, and then how does one, how, what's the concept for I amness?
There's no concept.
Oh,
there's no definition. It's just a feeling of presence. Sense of being or sense of awareness, and with that sense of awareness, a sense of being, a sense of presence, there's a sense, oh, I am. I think, therefore I am. Or, you know, I presence, therefore I am. I vibrate, therefore I am, you know, or whatever, you know. I'm aware, so, you know, I am. So there's a sense of I am-ness that can still remain. And so letting go of that, then the mind opens up to a whole other level of release, of openness. So then, you know, this idea of becoming the Dharma rather than becoming the stream rather than being a little bit, you know, distinct from it.
That reminds me, I had some notes from Philip Overton when he was here. He spoke of no separation, meaning, sounds like what you're saying for the arhat.
That was a Zen idea, I think, that when there's no separation between yourself and what's happening, you simply are happening along with what's happening. Is that
it could be described that way. However, it doesn't make any sense. The experience doesn't make any sense because whenever you have no separation, there's still some idea of I am in that. I'm not separated from you. Both idea of separation and non-separation disappear. There's no reference point to say we're separated or not separated.
I found it very intriguing when you said the different fetters that fall away through the stages, and that the conceptual and the physical boundary of sort of self goes away first, and then goes away the sensual pleasure and the likes and dislikes. Sometimes I feel in my meditation, especially if they're guided meditations, so I can really concentrate it, that the sense of boundary, say, if I'm listening to sound, as Norman Fisher, I think, led us through the other day, Sati Center event, that I disappeared and the we were just listening to sounds in the environment, and there was really no distinction between me, the listener, and the sounds. The sounds and me, it was really, really one space and just sounds emerging. But there was a very clear distinction between the sounds I liked, and I didn't even have a notion of that's a car, that's a door slamming, and that's. But there was a very distinct sense of I like that this sound is pleasant and this sound is unpleasant. Is that sort of the same level? I mean, are you talking? I mean, do you have the same gradation in an individual meditation experience? Sort of the boundary of the self goes away. I'm not saying there was no sense of self, but there was sort of, you know, much more. But the sense of like and dislike was very clearly present.
The sense of what?
Like and dislike, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, was very clearly there.
So there's a distinction between things being pleasant and unpleasant, versus liking and not liking what's there. So things might be very unpleasant or very pleasant in enlightened awareness, but there wouldn't be any liking or disliking particularly.
I'm not even aware of the distinction.
Oh, that's a very important distinction.
Could you make that further? It really seems the same. It seems to be if it's... you mean you're talking about the clinging and the attachment.
Yeah, so...
To the pleasant, and you want more of that, and you want less of the sort of leaning into and leaning away?
There can be unpleasant experience and no disliking of it, no aversion to it. Just there, and what you're willing to be there, okay, it's okay, I'll let it be there. And then there can be pleasant experience, the same thing, just let it be there, it's okay. The mind is equanimous, at peace with it.
Something I should have known. I mean, it's just something you forget and you have to be brought back to.
And so that's a very important distinction to make, because in that gap, or in that space between pleasant and unpleasantness, and liking and not liking, is a chance for liberation. Is to be free, find some freedom there.
So what you're saying is, arhant will still know the difference between pleasant and unpleasant, but won't have any like and dislike.
I'm not an arhat, so I can't say. I think so.
I'm stuck back on the deathless when you said that, can't remember exactly how you said it, but what I heard was that it's an awareness or a consciousness.
Dimension of consciousness or awareness.
And that it's timeless.
In the same way that the present moment is a timeless present. It has no...
Right. Okay. Over and over, Buddha says that consciousness is conditioned on the object and the organ that's sensing it. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a sutta in which he says there's any other consciousness than the conditioned kind.
Mostly that's what he talks about. And mostly when he talks about consciousness in the conditioned types, he refers to that consciousness which belongs to the five aggregates. The five aggregates, the five skandhas. So form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And that's primarily the kind of consciousness that arises at the various sense doors. So when there's sight consciousness that arises. And if there's no sight, then there's no sight consciousness that arises. If there's no smell, there's no smell consciousness that arises. If there's no taste, there's no taste consciousness that arises. That particular sense consciousnesses arise with the contact with that sense. And the mind is the same way. There's a particular kind of mind consciousness that only occurs when, for example, a thought arises and you know that thought is happening, or other things internally. The Buddha also talked about consciousness without feature, or a consciousness which is luminous. And it's a little bit hard from these kinds of texts to pull it all out. But the way that the parts of the Theravada tradition understand it, and the way scholars some pull it out understand the text, is that the only way to understand, or the best way to understand what nirvana is, this experience of nirvana, it is not some kind of external reality you're tuning into, but rather it's this dimension of the mind, dimension of consciousness, that consciousness which has no object, which stands outside of objects in a sense. It's bigger than objects. And so it's not being defined or arising because of a particular object, you know, sense object, sense experience. So it is a form of consciousness, but it's not the consciousness that's usually we're living in.
Another point of the deathless that I find fascinating is that there are actually very credible, serious
modern physicists who are doing work to try and come to a better understanding of why things work the way they do than what we have now, more unified. And they're actually beginning to throw time out of the picture at the very... that very, very objective level of what's really there. And to me, that seems intuitively correct for reasons I could go on about for a long time. But I think that that is a very dear thing to me, is the sense of being... This body and this mind will always be completely convinced of it. There's no way out of that. But at the same time, there may be a deeper knowing that, and it goes along with this idea that everything is okay and perfectly and precisely okay, that, and it always has been and always will. And to me, it's just exciting to see that there are people that are taking it into physics as well. So,
great.
You know, it may be that after 3,000 or 6,000 years or however long it takes, people go, ah, that's what he meant.
So one of the consequences of stream entry is the person knows now what the path is. Knows that the path is found by being fully present, immediately present for what's happening in the present moment now. That's where it's found, seeing there. That's the doorway in. And that happens to be the same practice that gets you to stream entry. So in a sense, stream entry is a little bit of an arbitrary division in terms of the practice a person would engage in. It's kind of like a little encouragement along the way. But before and after, you do the same practice. And that's important because one of the forms of religious identity that people get attached to, even though you're supposed to know better at this point, is that of becoming attached to your identity as a stream enterer. And there's a lot of suffering in Buddhist communities, in some Buddhist communities, around who has it and who doesn't have it, and I don't have it, and I'm supposed to have it, and I'm not. It's just awful. And I think it's best not to be too concerned about it. If it can be inspiration and encouragement in your practice along the way, then great. And it could maybe be helpful as you go further in practice. It might be nice to know that this is a possibility, or you might get close to it. But there are some people who don't know they have the experience. Some people maybe will never have it. There are different ways in which the spiritual life unfolds. And it's best not to have a linear model. It's best not to have one particular tradition's model as being the model of how it has to happen. But be very deeply respectful for your process. And one of the things that I was hoping to convey today is that in order for this Dharma practice to unfold in a healthy way, is for us all to, in a sense, relax into what the present moment experience is and to trust that, into the immediacy of this very moment's experience. And there's a lot of complicated ways in which we relate to the present moment. And beginning to understand those complications is a very important part of the practice. And to slowly learn how just to relax and just kind of be willing to just ride the revelation of the present moment. Wow, that's happening. And let it reveal itself. And I believe that there's a kind of an intelligence or logic or reason or causal nexus that our present moment experience is in if we're fully present in the moment for what's unfolding. The psyche, the mind, reality kind of knows what's needed to be revealed in order for the psyche, the mind, to let go deeply enough to become free. So I think one of the most wonderful ways of attaining freedom is to very, very deeply trust this present moment experience as it's unfolding. Almost, you know, become it. Let it kind of move through you. Let yourself be moved by it. Let yourself be filled with it. And in being filled with that experience, let your knowing of that experience be clear and crisp. Oh, this is what's happening. So there's a two-part movement. Letting yourself be filled with the present moment experience, whatever it might be, trusting it's okay to have your experience as it is. And then in some capacity of the mind, know what that experience is. To let yourself be filled with the experience is to be filled with embodiment, often, mostly. To let yourself really be embodied in that experience you're having. And then the mental side of it is as clear knowing of what that experience is, as clear as you can. And it's the combination of those two, the embodied sense of the present moment, coming into the present moment, being embodied in the present moment in all these different ways, and the mental aspect of clearly knowing what it is, that's the clearest way, I think, to liberation, to freedom, at least the healthiest. So these exercises we did today, I hope you remember them well enough that you do them again. And you don't have to do it with someone, but you could certainly do them alone. Reflect on these things, try to learn, try to stay in that flow of your immediate experience, moment by moment by moment. Notice, why is it you don't trust the present moment? Notice what gets in the way of being fully present for the present moment. And just be with what's being revealed in any given moment. It's 3:10, and we have 20 minutes to cover something we're supposed to cover today, but we don't have to, which is bodhicitta. To talk about bodhicitta properly means covering 2,000 years of Buddhist history in 20 minutes. So I'm not going to do that to you. But let me say this, and then we'll do a little sitting to end. Often the experience of defining ourselves in a particular way, this is who I am, becomes a kind of a barrier, a shell, between ourselves and fully experiencing what's there in front of us. If that experience of that shell drops away, and we can really, even just begins to soften, and we can begin experiencing the present moment, the flow of the present moment, fully and completely into that emptiness of the mind, then one of the qualities of that open communication, that open perception of other people, other beings, is one of empathy, one of feeling with someone else and being with them. And that's one of the really beautiful qualities of a human being, is that capacity of empathy, of feeling. And the more empty we are of ego, the clearer and cleaner that empathy can be. And that empathy then, because there's a lot of suffering in the world, that empathy takes form of, in the context of suffering, of compassion. And for some Buddhists, at some point they get a sense of the magnitude of suffering in this world. And they get a sense of how we're not so separate from others, or in a sense of how we're sensitive, very deeply sensitive to other beings, that the concern for other people's welfare becomes almost as strong or perhaps stronger than concern for one's own welfare. And so then practicing in order to support other people, help other people, becomes a motivating force in one's life. And it isn't something you have to construct or make up or think you have to do because you're supposed to be a good person, but rather something deeply innate in experience itself, in the flow of this movement of experience as we let it reveal itself in the present moment. One way of understanding this is that as the filters for awareness drop away, as the definitions that contract awareness, that keep it limited, fall away, and awareness becomes more and more spacious or open or expansive, more empty in a sense, that awareness doesn't exist independent from all the rest of our psychophysical being. You know, our psychophysical being is kind of a whole. It all works together. And so there's a kind of inherent in that open awareness is a support of the intelligence of the rest of our being, rest of our psychophysical being. There's intelligence in that awareness. So awareness by itself is not understood to be something that's kind of, you know, dull like a mirror, like, you know, just sees and that's it. But in that open awareness of the mind, there's all the intelligence of the mind, all the functionality of the mind is still there, but there's no tendency to cling or to contract or to define any part of ourselves by it. So all this intelligence is there. And so what Buddhists like to say is that in emptiness, there is compassion. In open awareness, there is compassion there. There's a movement of compassion there that seems almost part of it because we don't, you know, all this other stuff is there. But in the clarity of the awareness, it just seems like awareness is what is. But of course, there's more to awareness than just more to being human being just awareness. And so there's this intimate connection in the Mahayana tradition between emptiness and realization and awakening and the experience of compassion. And the compassion comes with it. And then it becomes a very important motivator for some people. And some people's their practice is organized around compassion, the concern for others. They feel that they're practicing in order to benefit other people as well, that they're including the benefiting others in their own practice. And the last thing I want to say is that I believe that sooner or later, a person will stop practicing unless they have some sense that their practicing is also to benefit other people, other beings. Now, there's nothing wrong with a person stop practicing. So I'm not saying it's, you know, they're not doing it right. I'm just saying that unless, if you want to continue practicing after a certain point, and the different people at that point is different places, it only makes sense, the only motivation is only there if we have some sense of how that's going to be supportive and helpful for other people as well. That's kind of part of our heart, the heartfelt motivation. So, I hope it was okay to talk so much, but that was not what I had in mind. I wanted to be more experiential. They didn't want to talk about things. So let's make up for that. We're just sitting. As we're sitting here, I wonder if you can have some sense of the timelessness that we're sitting in, the timeless present. This particular moment exists only right now. It'll never happen again. But as this timeless moment happens, it's within an ocean, a great big field of eternal present, timeless present. No beginning, no end. And the awareness that senses the timeless present, perhaps you can feel it as awareness which is boundless. The awareness itself is timeless, expansive, an awareness which is not defined by the body, by the feelings, the perceptions, an awareness which is not defined by anything at all, an awareness which is infinite and empty and filled with all things. So, thank you for being here and going along, and I hope that today, some way or other, proves useful for you in your life and your practice. And it'd be lovely if somehow this day challenged you to look at the area of trust more deeply, confidence, and that maybe you could discover how to have a greater degree of trust in what arises in this wonderful life of ours.